From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Froneberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. It's such a pleasure and honor to be here and talk to you today. Our program is about Iraq 10 years later, and we're going to have we've got three veterans that are going to be in the studio answering your questions, concerns, whatever you want to know about Iraq. We're going to go back to 2003 and maybe even a little bit earlier with some of these guys, right up until the last troops are hopefully going to be leaving there soon. That's going to be the main topic today, and we want to make sure that you can get in on the conversation if you'd like. You can give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825 to voice your opinion, ask questions, tell your story. That's what we're here for, folks, is to tell your stories. That's what Veterans Radio is dedicated to, is getting the stories of America's veterans out to the world, if possible. You can follow us on the internet at veteransradio.net. You, evidently, according to our crack assistants, you can also follow us on Facebook. That's Veterans Radio on Facebook, and also on Twitter, Veterans Radio at Twitter. And just send us a tweet, and maybe we can I can finally actually figure out how to do that. So we're coming into the high-tech 21st century here. Those of us here at Veterans Radio. But first, we're going to talk to a guest who was on the program a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the Michigan War Dog Memorial. And this is Phil Wheatloff, who is here to give us an update on what happened. You were dedicating your memorial there out in Lyon Township in Michigan to the War Dogs. And Phil, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. Good morning. Yeah, I'd like to just bring you up to speed. The event was an absolute success. It took a couple months getting it all planned up. There were several VIPs showed up. Approximately 250 people were there, along with about 40-plus canines.
Oh, that's neat.
And the program lasted for about an hour. We had several different speakers, and it was just an absolute great success, and we're real happy with it.
I understand that you had dog handlers from different eras.
Yes, we had dog handlers from the Vietnam War, as well as we had the Michigan State Police was there with their canine units. The Oakland County Sheriff Patrol was there. And we had the Michigan Search and Rescue Group there. They had four dogs. They had three trackers and one cadaver dog. And they just give us a big talk on the special training that they give them and some of the experiences they've been through. So it was a very, very enjoyable day, people, it's very educational to understand how these dogs are trained and what they're doing for us.
So. Well, we know that it, because of your work and efforts of your organization, that Michigan now has March 13th as War Dog, give me the name of it again.
It's Canine Veterans Day.
That's it. Canine Veterans Day is March 13th. But you've also, this is starting to expand around the country.
Yes, it is. We was able to secure a proclamation through Governor Snyder last year of making Michigan as Canine Veteran Day on March 13th. Then we pursued a little further. We sent a copy of that proclamation out to every governor in the United States. And so far we have 13 states now have signed up. We'll take one more step. We're actually got a senator that's sponsoring a bill. We're going to try to go through Congress to make March 13th Canine Veteran Day nationally.
I think that that's great. I really I applaud all the work that you and the Michigan War Dog Memorial people have done. And I understand that people can donate to this great cause. And how would they go about doing that?
Well, you can visit our website, which is www.mwdm.org. That's mwd.org. And matter of fact, if you'd like to see how the Canine Veteran Day ceremony went, we have our pictures loaded on the website today.
Okay, so that's cool. I want to remind people that, that live in the local Ann Arbor or Michigan area that you can go and see this Michigan War Dog Memorial at the intersection of 11 Mile Road and Milford Road in Lyons Township, Michigan. And it's a great memorial, and I'm really pleased that Veterans Radio has been able to promote this for you. And I really encourage people to go out there. It's really a powerful little memorial. Hopefully it becomes bigger and bigger as you go along.
Yeah, we have a five-year plan right now. It's in order. And we're, you know, we've just recently put our vision out there, what we want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, several people are starting to support it. We're looking for corporate sponsors, naturally.
Of course, we can relate to that.
Yep.
I got to let you go, but you had something that you would like to read to us today.
Yes. for me to leave right now, I'd like to just finish off by reading The Guardians of the Night. Most dog handlers know about this. The author's unknown. But this is a canine talking to his handler. So
okay.
It starts off, says, "Trust me, my friend, for I am your comrade. I will protect you with my last breath. When all others have left you and the loneliness of the night closes in, I will be at your side. Together, we will conquer all obstacles and search out those who might wish harm to others. All I ask is your compassion, a caring touch of your hand. It is for you that I will substitute give my life and spend my night unrested. Although our days together may be marked by the passing of the seasons, may that each day at your side be my reward. My days are measured by the coming and going of your footsteps. I anticipate them at the opening of the door. You are the voice of caring when I'm ill, the voice of authority over me when I've done wrong. Do not chastise me unduly, for I am your right arm, the sword at your side. I will attempt to do what you bid of me. I seek only to please you and remain in your favor. Together, you and I shall experience a bond only others like you understand. When outsiders see us together, their envy is measured in disdain. I will quietly listen to you. I pass no judgment, nor will your words be repeated. I remain silent, ever vigilant, ever loyal. And when our time together is done, and you move on in this world, remember me with kind thoughts and tales. For a time, we were unbeatable. Nothing passed among us undetected. If we should ever meet again in another field, I will gladly take up the fight. I am a military working dog, and together, we are guardians of the night."
Thank you very much, Phil. The Michigan War Dog Memorial, that's MWDM.org. Go to their site. Help them out if you can. If you're in the area, go out and visit that memorial. Thanks very much for being on Veterans Radio again. We'll be right back in just a moment talking about the 10-year anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu. Or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio, and some of you are probably surprised that we're listening to Vietnam-era music, but we conducted a thorough survey of all of the veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan, and they said that they liked that era music better than anything else. That's not true, but that's what we decided to go with today from our unofficial survey. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. We're going to be taking a look at the Iraq War 10 years later, just to see you know, what the thoughts were of some of our veterans. We've got three of them available today, two in the studio and one on the phone. And we're going to be talking about them with them about the beginning of the Iraq War. And we're not going to talk necessarily about the politics of it, but just, you know, what they did and how they served and what their jobs were. Joining me in the studio right now, number one on my left, is Damon Peterson. And Damon is an Air Force veteran, a captain of the United States Air Force, retired. He was in country in 2003 and earlier, but he can't talk about that. at least not for the next 30 years. And Damon, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good afternoon, Dale. How are you doing today?
I'm doing terrific, and I'm really excited to have you on the program. Tell me a little bit of just a bit about what your assignments were in Iraq when you got there to begin with.
Well, when we first got in the country, we were basically just an observation and report, kind of like a LRP, alert, long-range reconnaissance patrol. We kind of saw what was going on, got information back to the base, and tell them about personnel, movements, vehicles, the layout of the land, who were the chieftains, and who were the people, the players that were involved in making the decisions for the whole regions.
Okay. I know you can't go into too much detail, but I didn't realize that the Air Force had sort of special operations teams, but it was something along those lines where you were kind of just keeping you were the eyes and ears before everybody got there?
Yeah, kind of like the eyes and ears of the Air Force. And basically, whenever a top-of-the-spear team went out on deployment or went out on a mission, we kind of were there with them, but we were already ahead on the ground letting them know the intel of the area.
Okay. I'll keep that right. And you were there in 2003, and then you went back again, but as more of a security person.
Yeah.
In 2000 whenever. Okay. He's very secretive. He's even got, you know, blinders on, so I can't see who he really is. Also in the studio with me right now is Staff Sergeant Mike Shinsky. And Mike was in Kosovo first, but then you ended up in Iraq in February of 2004 through February 2005, a combat engineer team leader. Jeez. Welcome to Veterans Radio, Mike.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Tell me a little bit about what your job was in Iraq at that time.
So I was part of the 9th Engineer Battalion, 1st Infantry Division, and we were assigned to the northern tip of the Sunni Triangle in Samarra. We served as the QRF for an infantry task force.
What's that?
It's the quick reaction force, and basically anytime anything went down outside the wire, if there was an attack or if there was an IED, we would either escort the EOD team or we would go out to support the unit being attacked. We did that, and we also did all the engineer-specific missions. We did route clearance, IED removal, demolitions on things that needed to be done. Also, I served as an EOD technician for about 4 months during that deployment, and we covered the majority of Samarra and Tikrit area. Mm-hmm. We did disarming IEDs as well as disposing of captured enemy ammunitions. And I think the biggest shot that I did was about 250,000 pounds of explosives in one bang.
Wow. Okay. Well, it looks like you have all your fingers, and that's good.
Luckily, I do.
All right. Thanks, Mike. And joining me on the line also is Staff Sergeant Eric Wiltfang. And Eric, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hello.
Good morning. So tell me when you were there and what your job was.
We went there, would have been January of 05 to January of 06 or whatever, and we were initially an armor unit, but at that time there weren't a lot of need for tanks, so we only used our tanks, you know, a couple dozen times throughout the whole year, but we were kind of the tasked out to do anything and everything because we were attached to an infantry unit and a scout unit, so we just kind of had a hodgepodge of soldiers mixed up in our company, and we just kind of did a handful of everything going on in the area.
Okay, and you were in the Army also?
Yes.
All right, and so I'm going to ask you first, Eric. Were you in the service prior to 2003?
Yes, I joined right after high school in 2002.
Okay, and what were your thoughts when you found out that you were going to be going to Iraq?
We didn't really go, like I said, 12-5, so it was kind of kicked off and been going on for a while, so I mean we had plenty of time to prepare, you know, mentally and everything to get, you know, in the mindset of that, you know, it's not a matter of if we're going, just a matter of when we're going. So
mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
That's all right. where were you based out of? Where were you coming from?
I was stationed out in Fort Riley, Kansas.
Okay. Oh, that's right, because you said you were a Big Red One.
Yes.
Okay. So my partner Bob's very excited about that. He's got a Big Red One hat on now. He's jumping up and down doing a cheer. but so you were coming from Kansas, and Mike, you were also? with the Big Red One at one point?
I was 1st Infantry Division out of Germany.
Okay. I remember the big... Anyway, that's another story when I talk about the Big Red One. I'm curious. I want to read something from an article that I got yesterday, you know, and said that, you know, that this week marks the 10th anniversary of the United States' entry into Iraqi Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom. And the thing that really surprised me a lot were the numbers of casualties and so forth that occurred in Iraq. And these were taken from a website called Statista.com and other sources. We found that the Iraq cost approximately 4,500 American lives. 32,000 were physically wounded. 122,000 Iraqi civilians were also killed in the operation, and the cost was over $800 billion. That's a lot of money when we think about it. And I'm not going to ask the question whether it was worth it or not, because we talked briefly about this before we went on the air. And when you're in the service, you really could care less about the politics of whatever it is that you're involved in. The whole thing is just to make sure that you protect your friends and get everybody home safe and sound. So I'm going to come back to Damon here with the Air Force and say, so how did they prepare you to go into Iraq? I mean, how did they sell this idea of this war to you?
Basically, the officers in charge kind of told us, be prepared to go to this country and inspect for weapons of mass destruction and kind of get the layout of the land, find out what's going on, report back anything you see, no matter what the minor detail is, report everything you see back.
Mm-hmm. Mike, what about you? How did they prepare you for this adventure?
We were actually slated to go to Kosovo when everything happened, so we used our Kosovo deployment as a train-up. And then when we found out we were going to Iraq, we were actually scheduled to be the unit that went in from Turkey down from the north to meet 101st coming up from the south. So when that got canceled, we'd actually been training for Iraq for close to 2 years by the time we went. So when we got there, it wasn't that much of a shock.
Except for the heat. So you were part of the organization that was originally designed to come down into Iraq from Turkey, but that was nixed by Turkey, I think it was, right?
Right. Turkey voted no troops.
Right. And so you ended up coming down and going up through Kuwait.
We took over. We were OIF-2, so we flew into Kuwait, and then from Kuwait either convoyed or flew up to Anaconda, which is a big air base, and then drove to our base in Tikrit.
Okay. And Eric, what about you? Where'd you come from? I know you came from Fort Wiley, but did you go straight to Iraq, or how did you get there?
We came in through the Kuwait area. We did kind of prepping or, you know, overview of the area and everything in Kuwait, and then we just convoyed up. We didn't drive our tanks. They were on the back of HET trucks, save fuel and everything for that. But, we just convoyed up. We were on our tanks and everything on the back of the trucks and just went right to our destination.
So, Damon, what did you find when you first went in there? What was the reception, let's put it that way? Were the Iraqis glad to see you, or were they upset?
We first got there, the Iraqis kind of had mixed emotions. They were kind of like, well, who are these guys here, and what are they here to do? They were watching us probably more than we were watching them. So I would say it was a mixed reception. They kind of wanted us to see what we were there to do and kind of watched our every move from the time that we got in country to the time that we left. We figured that we probably had eyes on us at every second of every day.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mike, you mentioned about the eyes on you every day earlier when we were talking, and so you went out into the towns to clear them out, right?
Right. Pretty much on a regular basis, we would either do foot patrols or mounted patrols through the city, as well as the route recons outside of the city.
And what type of reception did you get?
We were in a fairly contested area. I'm not sure if you're familiar, when the Civil War almost started, that big gold mosque that was blown up, that was in the city of Samarra, which is where I was.
Okay.
So there was mixed receptions depending on who was looking at us. The majority of the Iraqi citizens were somewhat grateful that we were there. I mean, they would show their thanks or hold out the white flags as we drove by or mm-hmm. have signs. It was the other half of the city that didn't take too kindly to us being there.
But Eric, what about you when you got there a little bit later?
I don't know if it'd be like close to 50-50, but I mean, obviously there's people that didn't want us there, and then the other people that did. Our big city that we were around was Khan Banisad, and that was a bigger suburb, and they were good for the most part. But the smaller outlying towns or villages, if you want to call them, they also are kind of both, you know, half and half too, because you know a lot of them, you know, we'd only go out there once a week or whatever to some of these smaller villages. So, like the kids were always excited, you know, because back then was when we were doing the candy thing to all the kids and everything. So when we'd roll in to those little towns, we, you know, not be bum rushed, but they'd be out on the side of the road just kind of waving and waiting for, you know, the candy to be thrown or toys or whatever we had donated to us to kind of hand out there. So, I mean, we weren't hated everywhere, but we weren't 100% liked either.
Mm-hmm. Did you, you know, there is a book out there by one of our guests on Veterans Radio a number of times, a guy named Bing West, and he wrote a book called The Strongest Tribe. And part of the premise of that book was that the strongest tribe in Iraq would win. And because it is such a tribal area, and most of us are not familiar with that, or you know, especially civilians in there, did you find that there were what the warring factions were? Did you run into any of that? I'll start off with Mike. Did you run into that with the Sunnis, Shias, and
we didn't run into
some bases?
Right. We didn't have too much tribal conflict in our area. The majority of the clash was either between the Sunni and the Shia, or the majority of the people who were fighting against us were actually foreign fighters.
Oh, okay.
Not very many of the people that were attacking us or captured were actually Iraqi citizens. So we were kind of in an area that was more Sunni and Shia conflict than tribal conflict.
That's interesting, because I don't think we got a lot of that in the news about, you know, where these bad guys were coming from. You know, we always thought that was going like that. I mean, we heard it from some sides of the argument. Where did most of these people come from that were foreigners?
That I'm not sure of. I knew we had quite a few that were coming from North Africa region.
Okay. Eric, did you have that similar experience?
A little bit. I mean, there was the conflict, but it really didn't impact our mission or what we were doing over there. I mean, if they were fighting against each other, they kept it between them, and we didn't really run into an issue with any of that while we were conducting our mission or whatever we had going.
So was there actually a civil war going on? I'm kind of throwing that over. You know, it's once we came in and got rid of Saddam, you know, what happened? You know, what should we be aware of when it comes to that? I'll come back to you, Damon.
I don't know what was happening in the later years. In the earlier years, you kind of had the Sunni and the Shias kind of fighting to find out who's going to win, and trying to see everybody was jockeying for power. Like some of the imams were telling, from the villages were telling their people to kind of be hesitant about who you tell tribal business to. So they kind of were hands off of non-Muslims, and even people that weren't from that region, they kind of stuck to their self and kind of stayed out of everyone's hair.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to fly up under the radar.
Yeah, Mike?
I know Iraq under Saddam, the majority of Iraq is the Shia Muslims, while the majority of the Muslim community is Sunni. So the Sunnis were in power under Saddam, and he kept the Shia out of power. And then once he was gone, the Shia, which was the majority of Iraq, kind of filled all of the newly created government positions, and then in turn were kind of discriminating against the Sunni who have held power so long. And it turned less into tribal conflict, but more the sectarian Sunni against Shia, which almost started the state of civil war.
Yeah. Eric, what about when you were there?
Honestly, I didn't get too political when I was there, because I was just, you know, a younger kid. I wasn't too wrapped up in the whole politic issues, as it was just, you know, going there and doing what I had to do with the guys there and everything. So, like I said, I just kind of let, you know, people that worry about that, that need to worry about that, where I just focus more on what I had to do.
You just wanted to stay alive.
more or less.
Yeah. No, I certainly understand that. I find it curious when we're talking about it, we look back at the history of the Iraq War. It's going to be interesting to see what happens 30 years from now when we look back on it, because I know with the Vietnam thing, they're still taking it, you know, dissecting it and trying to figure out what was happening at the same time. Damon, you were there at the beginning. What was your reaction when they came in, or when we came in and we kind of dissolved all of the existing military and security programs that were there? You know, because you guys had to jump in and fill that void.
To me, it was kind of like a shock, because we were given orders, and the orders could change on the hour. Like, they kind of tell you, you have your mission at this point is to escort all the people out of the area, and then an hour later you might get another set of orders telling you to escort only the major players and the tribal leaders and probably the sectarian leaders of the area in and out of, escorted them to safety.
Okay, I don't want to say it was chaos, but it sounds a little bit like it was a little bit disorganized.
Yeah, it was. Early on, it was very disorganized, but then they kind of set rules of engagement up, because when we first got there, you couldn't even raise your weapon at a person unless they actually fired at you. So you could be getting shot at unless a bullet was close enough where you could hear it or it whizzed by you. You couldn't even engage.
Well, I understand that the rules of engagement. Did you have problems with those rules of engagement? No, you just shot back.
We had a very, very different set of rules and rules of engagement from where we were. I don't know if it was the area or the command, but ours was at the beginning of the war, it was if you felt threatened for your life, then you had the right to defend yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to have a bullet come close to you. If a insurgent had a weapon and even you thought that he was about to raise it at you, and then you had that right to defend yourself.
You don't have to answer this if you don't want to, Mike, but you know, we hear all these rumors about that the local militias or whatever would sometimes put children or women in front of them when they would come after you guys, and you know with the thoughts that, well, Americans, you know, we always wear the white hats and we're not going to shoot at these children. Did you ever have that problem?
On several occasions, like Damon was saying, the kids would, you know, expect candy, and they took advantage. The insurgents took advantage of that. We'd be driving down the road, and they would see, you know, soldiers hanging out of the vehicles to throw candy. Well, then they realize if they're throwing candy, then they're not having their weapons. So mm-hmm. they would get a couple insurgents to stand in a big group of kids, and when we would throw candy, all the kids would run for the candy, and then the insurgents would pick up their weapons and start shooting at us.
Oh, man. Wow. Eric, did you have that problem?
Personally, no, but some of the other platoons in our company ran into some stuff similar like that there.
How did you, Eric, I'm going to ask you, how did you feel about the support that you had from the local Iraqis? Did that change while you were there, or was it more supportive or less supportive?
You mean civilian-wise or their...
Yeah, civilian-wise.
I think it got more supportive towards the end, because when we were wrapping up at the end of our deployment, they had that big election happen right there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, people were pretty supportive, and a lot of people, you could tell they were happy. We had all the, I don't want to say propaganda posters, but the posters are telling them to, you know, get out and vote, because, you know, they're able to for the first time. So a lot of people were, you know, supportive. You know, a lot of, like, the local shops downtown, you could see would have those posters hanging on the walls down in the market square or whatever. So I think them being able to hang up those posters to say, hey, vote, you know, Tuesday or whatever day they voted on,
mm-hmm.
I think it was more, you know, showing, you know, not supporting us per se, but the fact that they had, you know, the right and freedom to be able to vote that year.
Okay. Well, we're coming up toward the bottom of the hour. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, and I'm asking people out there, if you'd like to get in on a conversation, you can give us a call here at 877-573-7825. If you've got a question for our guests, we've got Air Force, two Army guys, and we're going to, when we come back around the other side, I want to talk to you about as the Iraqis became more and more involved, especially the Iraqi military, if you ever worked with them or did not work with them, I do not know. But we'll be right back after these messages. You are listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Specialist Ross McGinnis threw his back against a grenade thrown into his Humvee, saving the lives of his crewmates. Details after this.
It's pouring rain. It's still dark outside. Your heart starts beating really, really fast. You've never done anything so hard in your life. This is boot camp. This is the real thing now. It's such extreme pain, you don't understand how you can finish. I began to feel that there was no way I was ever going to have my title, U.S. Marine. It takes special inner strength, courage, and desire to do this. I was just thinking, I'm so close. I'm so close. And when I finished, I was like, I'm done. I did it. The moment I will never forget is when this drill instructor that I admire so much comes up to me straight in front of me, put her arm on my shoulder and said, good morning, Marine.
PFC Summer Volkman became a United States Marine. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
On December 4, 2006, McGinnis was manning the turret in the last Humvee of a six-vehicle patrol in northeast Baghdad, when an insurgent threw a grenade from the roof of a nearby building. As he stood up to get ready to jump out of the vehicle, as he'd been trained to do, officials say McGinnis realized the other four soldiers in the vehicle did not know where the grenade had landed and did not have enough time to escape. He threw his back against the radio mount and smothered the explosive with his body. McGinnis was killed instantly, while the other four men survived. He was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously by President Bush on June 2nd. 2008. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Yes, and here we are. It's being heralded right now. That's right, springtime. The flowers are starting to bloom right here in the Midwest, and the temperature is rising. That means springtime. That means a whole lot for all you folks. You're going to be doing spring cleaning. You're going to take a look at some of that furniture and say, you know what? Hubby or spouse, we need to make a change. Well, where do you go for that, folks? Within Washtenaw County or southeastern Michigan or even Michigan whole, you go to Naked Furniture. And on the line right now with me is the president of Naked Furniture, Mr. Ron LaFleur. Ron, welcome
to
Veterans Radio.
Good morning, Bob. Thanks for having a wonderful show.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for being a sponsor on Veterans Radio. Now, you moved, and you're at your new location, but you still have some furniture that are big, big savings. Tell us about that.
Well, we have a lot of furniture left over from the sale. Most of it is half off right now. The new furniture is starting to arrive now. Our showroom is filling up with wonderful value.
And I was there the other day, folks. Let me tell you, it's a real wide-open, airy. They did some remodeling, and the way that they put that together, you can see the pieces just like you would see them in your home. Ron, I'm very impressed by what you folks did. Are you still having moving pains?
Well, my back still hurts, but we're giving really good deals, especially today is a wonderful day. I hope that your listening audience can get a chance to come in and see our wonderful new showroom packed with quarter sawn white oak Amish furniture.
Now, what about those that are a little bit outside of Washtenaw County, southeastern Michigan? Can they go on a website and find out a little bit more about you and get some more information?
Yep, NakedFurnitureAnnArbor.com is up and running. We don't show a lot of the Amish. It's best to come right into the showroom or give us a call. And we'd love to have you come in. We're running deliveries both today and tomorrow for the event. Our boys are on the road as we speak.
Now, what's that address?
3570 Washtenaw. We're right across from Starbucks in Arborland Mall.
Arborland Mall in beautiful, the garden spot of the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan, of course. And that phone number, area code 734-975-9080. And you're open today how long?
Till 7 o'clock today, till 6 o'clock tomorrow.
Oh, and it's nice and light out at 7 o'clock, so you can go in there and see that furniture. And you're going to be at 6 o'clock tomorrow. What time do you open in the afternoon?
10 to 7 today and noon to 6 tomorrow.
Boy, that's pretty easy to remember. 3570 Washtenaw Avenue across from Arborland Mall, and that's, of course, at 23 and Washtenaw Avenue in Ann Arbor, Michigan. 734-975-9080. Big savings, lots of discounts. Come on down and welcome spring. Ron, thank you very much for being on the program. I know you're busy. You got to get to the office right there and get yourself prepared for the fans and Veterans Radio that will be stopping by today. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Bob. Good day.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we are talking about Iraq 10 years later. What was going on at the time? We're talking with three veterans from Iraq. David Peterson was in the Air Force. Staff Sergeant Mike Shinsky was in the Army, Big Red 1, in 2004 and 5. And we've also got Staff Sergeant Eric Wiltfang on the phone. He was there in 2008 and 9. While we're off the air, you were talking, Mike, about the Iraqi military. And I wish you could tell our audience a little bit how it evolved during the time that you were there.
Right. So when we got into country, it was the Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, and they were just starting out. You know, they had little to no training. It was all volunteers. And these guys, you know, they had a lot of heart. They showed up and served this Iraqi Civil Defense Corps, even at the sake of their own safety. You know, they would wear ski masks to protect their identity as well as their family. While we were there, they transferred into the Iraqi National Guard with some more training. They got some new equipment. And then by the time I was leaving, they were actually the Iraqi Army. And while I worked as an EOD tech, we were actually helping to train the Iraqi Army EOD teams. And even as an engineer, we did a lot of work with the Iraqi Army, helping them train and get their facilities established. So it was a dramatic transition from when I got there to see this ragtag bunch of guys with mixed uniforms driving around in pickups to this actual military-looking unit when we left.
I think it's fascinating because, our perception was that they weren't helping, and I think that that's probably incorrect from what it sounds like. And they really had to put their lives on the line. It was more they were, you know, volunteers that were fighting for the survival of their country.
I think people here try to measure their success based on our standards, and it's just something you can't do. Their culture is completely different. The situation is different. You know, these guys, like you said, are doing this voluntarily at the risk of their own lives, not just from conflict, but their families are at stake, you know, and that's what happens. They'll target the families instead of the person. So they actually had some great success, and they helped. At least in my experience, they actually helped out quite a bit.
Well, Eric, you were there a little bit later. What are your thoughts about the Iraqi military?
I'm gonna agree with Mike there. I mean, I thought they did have a lot of heart, and they tried their best. And like you said, the culture is different, so you can't compare the Iraqi Army to, you know, the U.S. Army by, you know, success or anything like that. But I mean, the fact that they were out there doing what they had to do with, you know, we were riding around, you know, up our Humvees, and they were cruising around town in you know, S-10s or something to the equivalent of just a small pickup truck with no armor and just wearing, you know, a light vest like a cop would wear, nothing big and crazy. I mean, so these guys were going out there, you know, leading the pack. We were, you know, giving them the lead. So they were out there in front with little little armor and protection from them while we were kind of sitting towards the back with, you know, big armored, you know,
60 pounds of Kevlar on you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, they, you know, they were going in, you know, head first with little to nothing, and while we were kind of letting them take the lead so they can learn and do the mentor thing, but while we were, you know, so I felt, you know, felt a little bad that, you know, they were up there doing this, you know, all this with little to nothing while we were kind of sitting back, kind of like the fat guys in the back with, you know, all this protection. So they were, you know, they were going all out on a lot of the stuff that they were doing.
Well, if you, this is just your guesstimate there, Eric, I'm going to ask you first. When we're gone from there, which is pretty soon, I don't think there are, how many troops are left in Iraq right now? None? I'm sure there must be some sort of little force there to protect the embassies and so forth.
The last number I heard was probably around 40,000. Yeah, it was probably around 40,000, and that was a year ago.
Mm-hmm. So we're not paying a whole lot of attention to Iraq right now. Sort of like what happened with Afghanistan. You know, we didn't pay attention to them for a long time. But, so, you know, we're taking ourselves out of Iraq more and more. Eric, I'll ask you first. Where do you see Iraq going in the next 5 years, do you think? This is purely speculative.
Yeah, like there's always going to be, there's this group of guys that, you know, love what they do. They, you know, they love their country, and they're actually doing it for all the right reasons. And then there's the other half of guys that were, you know, doing it, I don't want to say just for a job, but, you know, they do it, they volunteer, and they're doing it just, you know, I don't know if they were doing it to make us happy while we were there, or they were doing it, you know, just to do something. But, I mean, if there are enough of those guys that are doing it for all the right reasons, then I think they can, you know, it's going to be a struggle once we're gone. But if there is enough of those guys out there trying to make their country better, then I think they'll should be all right. It just might take a little bit longer than we might want to see it,
mm-hmm.
as in the U.S. might want to. They might want it faster, but, I mean, it just might be a little bit slower than what our government wants to see happen.
Yeah. Well, we're pretty impatient when it comes to things like that. Mike, what do you think?
I agree. I mean, there are some guys who were just doing it, like doing the military or the government to collect a paycheck. But then there were some that were out there who truly wanted to see Iraq, you know, come up as a country. And I think they have a really good chance to do that as long as they can figure out a way to put aside these tribal differences and the Sunni-Shia conflict and work together as a government and, you know, run the country. They had a decent foundation to start from, and they just need to be able to work amongst themselves, and they have a really good chance to succeed.
Okay. Damon, what do you think? You were there at the beginning.
I kind of see it as a kind of 60-40 thing, where 60% of the country wanted to make that whole country better, and 40% were doing it to kick Taliban and Al-Qaeda out and just to make a paycheck and to keep their local tribe safe and not the whole country at large.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting when we think about, you know, what our perceptions of what we think should be going on over there and what actually is going on over there. And Mike, you brought this up earlier when you were talking about that we really didn't understand their culture. And, you know, that was what was so difficult, especially for us back here, when people are saying, well, why don't we just go in and take a city? Well, you know, you got 17 different ethnic groups in that city that don't get along.
Right. It's not like here where you know, you have pride in your country and then your state. Over there, it's family and then it's tribe and then it's country. So if you're trying to bring the country together and you have two tribes that are conflicting, well, they're gonna hedge with their tribe instead of the country, which is difficult. And like you said, you could have one little city that has 17 different tribes and, you know, the different religious sects, and it's hard to bring that together because they're so based on that family and tribe system.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that we don't remember is that Iraq really wasn't even a country until after World War I. And the British kind of pulled together all these different units and said, okay, now you're Iraq. And I don't think anybody really agreed to that organization at the time. So it's always interesting to see, you know, what our perception of the world is versus what your perception is once you get there and you actually see it. Because I know in my experience when I went to Vietnam, I had a totally different idea in mind of what the country was going to be like. And then I got there and go, oh, wait a minute, this is totally different than what they told me. And that we've got to figure out a way for all of these people to get along. If we're going to leave, we can't, you know, it's always like, we got to leave it better than it was when we got there. And I think that's what you guys tried to do. And it certainly sounds like that. We're going to have to take a real quick break here again. We're going to come back and kind of wrap this up. So if you've got a question you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking about Iraq 10 years later, and we're talking with three veterans. We've got two Army guys and one Air Force guy, and we're talking about the difficulty that we had once we got there and not really quite understanding exactly how the culture of Iraq was set up. And during the break, quick break, Damon, you mentioned something about, you know, even in the larger cities, you had such a mixture of tribes and subgroups of different cultures.
Well, like if we just take Baghdad in general, you might have six different tribes with six different dialects of Arabic all in the same territory. And then by the time we get there, I kind of make it as an analogy as a parent, six different kids with six different personalities and try to make them work together as a unit. A lot of times you're going to have headbutting, but we try to do the best we can to make them forget tribal and territorial fights and make it more of a look at the country as a whole and see the big picture and not just your small little territorial picture.
Well, what I want to do is we got about 10 minutes to go. So I'm going to go, Eric, I'm going to go to you, and I want to thank you, Kat, for her comments during the program. You must have a strong opinion. But if you were to look back on your experience in Iraq, how would you describe it?
I don't know. I don't want to say I
know we can't say we enjoyed it. People would never understand that we enjoyed being deployed. But other than that, what do you think that you were able to accomplish while you were there?
Like I said, I think our biggest thing when we were there was that election back in, was it 2005? We worked together with, you know, the local government and the city we were in, their local military. I mean, because there was all these threats of all the polling stations. They were all threatened, so we were out patrolling or sitting and guarding these polling stations. So I think that we were able to, you know, have a good, successful election in our town, in our area that year. That I think, you know, kind of led the effort and, you know, more of a democratic society for them and everything. So I'd say that election in 2005 probably would have been, you know, the highlight for us, you know, just for the Iraqi country in general.
So you feel positive about what you were able to accomplish there?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
that's good. You should. I think you should. Mike, how about you?
I feel the same way. I mean, if you look back, I was in some pretty hairy situations. I lost some good friends, but overall, it's an experience that has helped shape me now as well as my career in the military. And I don't know if I'd change it. One of the biggest things for me while we were over there is we were driving down the road and there was this gas station that had just been shot up by insurgents, and we stopped and pulled in and we talked to the guys and they told us what had happened, that insurgents were trying to put an IED in front of their gas station because it was the main route out of our base, and they told them no. Well, they had showed us the insurgents had thrown a couple hand grenades at their gas station that didn't blow up. And this was after I had done my EOD work. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, went back to the base, got some stuff, and I ended up being able to get rid of the hand grenades without damaging anything in their gas station. And from that day on, these guys would always come and let us know anything that was going on, and they were eternally grateful. And that was some a difference that I made, like, mm-hmm. personally and could see. And, you know, it's I think each person has something like that to where you see at least a little bit of good that you did, at least for one person or a family, and that's what you got to hold on to and take that with you.
I've heard that quite often, like when you're talking about that, is that once you were able to help these people and they saw that, again, that kind of goes back to the strongest tribe, when they found who's going to protect them, because all really people want everywhere is just a roof over their head, some food, and some, you know, and the understanding that they're going to be safe conducting their business. And because there was another book that we used on the program with a guy, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he was talking about when we first went in there that the, you know, American foreign policy was at the end of a gun held by an 18-year-old. And some of you guys were there when you were 18, and probably then you went back when you were 20, and it was probably a little bit different from a maturity standpoint on your part, correct?
Mm-hmm. I was 19 when I went to Iraq, and then 29 this last time in Afghanistan, and, you know, the differences for how you react and how you judge certain situations is completely different.
I would guess. David, what do you think? What did you take out of your experiences in Iraq?
I took out as every person who I interacted with in the country saw us less as a bully and more as people just like them who wanted to help him, who wanted to have their needs met, and who wanted to make sure that they were safe. That was the main point we tried to drive home. Listen, you gather up all your people who aren't able to fight, let mm-hmm. us take them and escort them to a safer area outside of the city or outside of the area that you think is a hot zone. Once they realized that, hey, we're here to help the women, the children, the elderly, we escorted them from their local tribes all the way into a safe zone or a safer zone outside of the city limits so they can mm-hmm. go about their business. And they realize, hey, all Americans aren't there just to be bullies and put a gun in their face. We're actually there to help and to mm-hmm. kind of have a rapport with that. I might be here with you, but I'm physically and spiritually, I'm here with you too. I understand your plight, and I want to make sure that this is your country when we leave, that you're going to be the one to have to take care of it. And
So we really were trying to win the hearts and minds.
Yeah, I think that's what our major goal was.
Which kind of was that General Petraeus wanted us to do that, and that also mm-hmm. that's another thing that Bing West talked about in one of the books he wrote earlier on. And that's what we tried to do in Vietnam. And it's, you know, as aside from the politics of stuff, when we do seem to get ourselves into these situations, we really do want to make them better for the people that are there. And we don't want to stay forever. We want to go there, do our job, and get out. My last question to each of you, we've got about 5 minutes left. I'm going to go to you, Eric, first. Are you still in the service?
Yes.
Are you career?
Probably I'm going to end up making it one. I just hit my 10-year mark last year, so.
Okay, so tell me where you are now and where you hope to be in 5 years.
Right now, I'm actually trying to look into reclass and get a little bit more out of the service. I mean, I've been armor and cavalry the last 10 years, so I'm kind of tired of going to sleep on the ground and everything like that. So I'm looking to get not a cushy job, but I want to kind of not ride my last 10 years out, but get a little bit something more out of.
I understand that.
Out of the service. I mean, I did, you know, I did the fun shooting stuff and everything when I was younger, and kind of want to mature and move on to something a little bit different here in the last 10.
Okay, and so are you? You are a staff sergeant.
Yes.
Right. What is that? E6, 7.
Six.
Okay. That's not bad money. It's not great money, but it's, you know, it comes in every month. That's a good part.
Exactly, yeah.
And so you're going to, if you do stick out to 20 years, if everything doesn't change the way they're talking, hopefully you should have some decent benefits. And I want to thank you for the service that you did, have done for us. Mike, what's in the future for you? You're graduating shortly?
Yes. I'll hit 13 years in this summer, and I hope to transition into the FBI. Just like Eric said, I did the run around, shoot 'em stuff as an engineer, infantry in my first part of my career, and then I transferred over to intelligence, and I've loved the job, and I want to continue doing it. Maybe not necessarily with the National Guard, but I would love to transition into the FBI and work for them.
Okay, so you are still in the National Guard.
That's correct.
Okay, and you're graduating in May from what school?
University of Michigan, go Blue.
There we go. Hopefully today we will do fine, too. Damon, so where do you want to be in 5 years? I know that you have retired.
In 5 years, I probably want to see myself working in a State Department. That's what I'd love to do. Diplomatic Corps, Public Affairs Corps, or maybe even a legal corps.
Mm-hmm. So you want to stay kind of in the government job working in those types of businesses?
Yes, I think that whether stateside in a legal career or in a foreign country, I'd see myself working for the State Department.
Okay. Now, I know you've done a lot of security work. Have you already done some civilian security work?
Yeah, I have.
Overseas types of things?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And now you're going to school, and when do you get done at Washtenaw Community College?
In May, and then Eastern in May of 2014.
And your degree will be what?
Criminal justice.
There we go. All right. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. It's a pleasure to have you on here, and I want you to good luck in everything that you do. Eric, thank you very much for being on the program.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you. Mike? Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Our pleasure. Damon?
Thank you for letting me come on the radio.
Talk
to my fellow veterans.
It's my pleasure. It's always fun to talk to our fellow veterans. And we've got a number of things that are coming up here on Veterans Radio. I want to thank these gentlemen for being on the program today. And if you've got a story or anything that you would like us to cover here on Veterans Radio, just get a hold of us. Send an email to Dale or Bob at veteransradio.net, and we will attempt to follow up. On that, we've got a number of different programs coming up in the next couple of weeks. Next week is going to be Dwight Zimmerman. We'll be on with At Ease and be talking about some books that are coming out that are dealing with the Iraq War, Afghanistan. He's also got to remember that he has written a book entitled Uncommon Valor. That's about 6 Medal of Honor recipients from Iraq and Afghanistan. So we're going to be talking about that book, and I think he's even going to try and give one away next week. So you have to tune in for that with one of his quizzes that he has when he's hosting the program, and I'll be here with him. The following week, I believe, is April 6th. That's our big one. That's the one we're going to be doing a program. Father Capon, Medal of Honor recipient from Korea, is we're going to be talking about him. And, Bob, you wanted to get in on this, right?
Yes, I do. I'm very excited about this. We're going to have the Archbishop of the Military. That's not his official title. I forgot what it was. But we're going to have him on the program. We're going to have some folks here from DEO. And what is that occasion? The priest, Father Capon, who was a POW in Korea, who died as a POW, is now going to receive the Medal of Honor. President Obama will be presenting that. No, we're not going to have that, but it's going to be nice. But it's going to be a couple days before that. April 6th, tune in. It's going to be a big extravaganza. Dale, take care.
All right. Yeah, I'm excited about that program also. If we go back into our archives, I'm sorry I don't have the dates, but we've done a couple of programs on Father Capon, and it was an amazing story about how he served the military and also took care of the men in the POW camps that he was in. Women in the Military coming up next month also, and then we've got a POW from the Hanoi Hilton from Vietnam who's also going to be on in April. It's going to be busy. You got a story, we'll talk to you about it. Get us on the air. We want to support you. We want to be the voice of America's veterans. Get these stories out. So until next week, my name is Dale Thronberry, your host, and you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.